wait for you to gavel and I should just wait up.
There we go. Today is April 25th, 2017. This is Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today we have two work sessions on two reports, an Oregon Health Authority report and a Department of Human Services report. Ms. Ames, the mighty Ms. Ames, do we have anything before we bring up entering work session?
We don't.
All right.
Go ahead.
All right. So with that, we'll go ahead and open a work session on the Oregon Health Authority report on emergency department boarding of psychiatric patients. We'll bring up Mr. Morris, Mr. Yoon, and Mr. Luck. Or it's probably Dr. Yoon and Dr. Luck.
Good morning, chairs and members of the committee. My name is Mike Morris. I'm the Behavioral Health Policy Administrator with the Oregon Health Authority. And we're here to present on the psychiatric boarding here in Oregon. And so this is part of a budget note from the 2015 session, and that we were directed to complete a study to determine the extent of ED boarding and then also to look at potential solutions for the problem. And so we then reached out and contracted with Oregon State University to conduct that study. And so I will let the researchers do their part as far as discussing the data. And then at the end, I'll talk about OHA's response to the report. So thank you.
So thank you for the opportunity to present our work. So our study, had three specific aims. First was to quantify magnitude of boarding of patients with mental illness in hospital emergency department in Oregon. Second was to identify factors contributing to the psychiatric ED boarding in Oregon. Third was to identify potential solutions to a problem. So we conducted a mixed method study, which involved one, analysis of quantitative databases currently available to study psychiatric boarding in Oregon, two, interview with mental health experts and other key stakeholders in Oregon. I will present key findings from quantitative analysis, and then Professor Love will talk about interview results. So I will talk about findings from our quantitative analysis in terms of the rate or extent of psychiatric boarding in Oregon and its recent trend. I will also present findings from our statistical analysis regarding factors contributing to psychiatric ED boarding. So we analyzed ED utilization and medical claims data retrieved from three independently maintained data sources in Oregon, including hospital discharge database, emergency department information exchange, or EDI, the Medicaid measurement information system. These data were supplied by Office of Health Analytics and the Oregon Association of Hospital and Health Systems. The Oregon Association of Hospital Health System performed data linkage to uniquely identify the same patients across three independent data sources. And we restricted our analysis to 1 year period from October 1st 2014 through September 30, 2015, for which complete data were available from all three data sources. And the linked data set we analyzed for this study included 690,245 unique ED visits on about 290,000 unique patients in Oregon. So conceptually, ED boarding can be characterized by patients for whom evaluation is complete and the decision has been made to admit or transfer, but there's no available inpatient bed. Currently, however, no standard definition for ED boarding exists, and the ED boarding has practically been defined as an ED stay longer than 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours, or 24 hours. Recently, the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education suggested 6 hour threshold, so our main analysis presented here adopted 6 hour definition and a more general 24 hour definition. And psychiatric visits were categorized into severe and non-severe visits. And the psychiatric ED boarding was defined as boarded ED visit that received psychiatric diagnosis. So again, we analyzed about 690,000 unique ED visits, and about 15% of these were psychiatric visits. Based on the 24-hour definition on the left-hand side of the slide, about 0.5% of all ED visits were body psychiatric visits. It was 2.1% for the 6-hour definition. Using this result, we estimate roughly 30,000 ED visits in Oregon during the one-year period were psychiatric ED boarding. The rate of ED boarding was substantially higher for psychiatric ED visits than for non-psychiatric ED visits. Based on the 6-hour definition on the right-hand side of the slide, 14.6% of all psychiatric visits were boarded visits, which is more than 3 times greater than 3.9% for non-psychiatric ED visits. And these estimates are comparable to national averages. The severity of psychiatric conditions appear to increase the chance of ED boarding. Based on the 6-hour definition, over 24% of all severe psychiatric visits were boarded, compared to less than 13% for non-severe psychiatric visits. This figure shows the rate of psychiatric ED boarding for different cutoff hours ranging from 6 hours to 24 hours. The rate here represents the proportion of boarded psychiatric visits in all psychiatric ED visits. We can see relatively greater drops in the rate of on the left side of the cutoff hour range. This implies reducing ED visits of patients who stay in EDs just over 6 hours may address an important portion of the psychiatric ED boarding problem in Oregon. This figure shows ED boarding time in Oregon. ED boarding time was defined as total ED hours less 6 hours for the 6-hour definition, and total ED hours minus 24 hours for 24-hour definition. If you on the right-hand side of the slide, for all boarded ED visits, the average boarding time was 17.6 hours. Which is about total 24 hours in ED. The average boarding time was 18 hours for psychiatric ED visits, 1 hour longer than 17 hours for non-psychiatric ED visits. The severity of psychiatric conditions significantly increased boarding time. Boarded severe psychiatric visits on average had 27 hours boarding time, so total 31 hours in ED. Almost twice as large as 15 hours for boarded non-severe psychiatric visits. This figure shows monthly trend in total hospital ED visits as well as boarded ED visits. As shown by the blue bars, total ED visits fluctuated over the year, showing some seasonality. In comparison, there was a downward trend in all boarded ED visits, shown by the orange line.
Chair. Oh, please, Representative Valenzuela.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Can you go back one slide, please? Thank you. So just trying to understand the 6-hour definition and the 24-hour definition, the psychiatric non-severe looks like there were less hours than the non-psychiatric. There were more hours spent.
Yes, exactly. That's what data shows.
What's the difference?
What's the cause for?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we, you know, based on the literature and my own, you know, research experience, you know, something like, So non-psychiatric, so in this case, let me try again. So non-psychiatric EDVGs, once being boarded, well, non-psychiatric EDVGs had, you know, about 2 hours longer boarding time than non-severe psychiatric PGs. Mm-hmm. And non-severe psychiatric PGs are usually involved, you know, just, you know, visiting ED for various reasons, you know, open times that doesn't require really medical attention.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes homeless people just, you know, seek for shelter in ED department, for example. And police department, the law enforcement may take the, publicly disturbing, you know, homeless people to ED department, at some, events that does not involve, you know, any crime or illegal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, those patients are released earlier than, on average, non-psychiatric ED patients, because no medically necessary, medical attention needed for those patients on average.
Okay, so considering follow up.
Oh, please.
So if you're, this scenario you're referring to would entail a police officer to get a call. He goes out and brings in the person, and they go to the psychiatric hospital, right? And then you do an analysis, you determine that no psychiatric support is needed, but he stays longer than a person who is needing psychiatric support, but it's not severe.
Yeah, so I mean, non-psychiatric visits are characterized by, for example, just a simple anxiety or really minor depression, and so on. So compare, being compared to those minor conditions, you know, severe psychiatric conditions involves like, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, and things like that. So minor depression compared to minor conditions compared to severe conditions usually, doesn't qualify for a person, in psychiatric patients in ED department for inpatient treatment.
Okay.
Please, Representative Maelstrom.
Okay, I'm a little confused. So if you have somebody that comes in and they're not known to the system for whatever reason, and it becomes quickly obvious this is a chronic mental illness, it's not, a super exasperated episode, they're homeless, they're not into care, how are they classified? Because you get a lot of those people in emergency rooms.
So, considering the scope of our analysis, our results are all based on claims data. So we used what's available in our claims data, and we used ICD-9 codes and CPT code, procedure code,
mm-hmm.
and admission, so ED admission and discharge hours to identify those, ED boarding and for psychiatric, non-psychiatric, separately for psychiatric, non-psychiatric PDS.
Follow up?
Please.
What's typical with somebody who you don't have a history, you look up and there's no history in this person, it takes a while to figure out what's going on with this person. How long are they held in the emergency room pending some sort of evaluation and plan? What's a typical, you know, person who's homeless with chronic mental illness, how long does it take to figure out what you're going to do with them?
So we don't have, you know, data specifically for, within our data, we don't have information for, you know, like, you know, specifically for homeless people.
Well, I'm just in general. I'm talking about somebody who's got chronic mental illness and they've got a whole laundry list of issues.
Well, I think they're more aggregating the data and then bringing that to us. So on the clinical side, they may not have necessarily the experience to get into those details of questions, but it looks like.
And right. I'm sorry, go ahead, Mr. Morris.
So co-chairs and Representative Maelstrom, so what they're presenting is the data for those who have an extended stay in the emergency department. And so they're, so you see, and there's two definitions. One is a 6-hour, so,
right.
And at what threshold do you call it emergency department boarding? And so you will see that typically the individuals are in and out of the emergency department, you know, within 6 hours.
That's what I was getting at. So
right.
those kinds of folks are more typically the 6-hour
right.
sort of people.
Right. And if you go back to the previous slide, it talks about, I think it's 14 point.
Right.
Is it 14.5? Around 14.2 are considered boarding incidents. So.
Okay, that's why I was trying to get a general view of that. So, okay, thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
Okay. So, the all EDDVGs, over EDDVGs just fluctuated without showing any specific trend other than seasonality, but poor EDDVGs showed downward trend over time. And this figure shows monthly trend in the proportion of poor EDDVGs, separately for psychiatric and non-psychiatric VGs. In total boarded EDVGs were the denominator. So gray line shows the proportion of boarded EDVGs, boarded non-psychiatric EDVGs in all boarded EDVGs decreased over time, a 16% annual decrease. In contrast, the proportion of boarded psychiatric EDVGs in all psychiatric EDVGs had an overall increase, 26% increase over the year, shown by the orange line. So taken together, our results show, although there was overall downward trend in all body EDVG, as we saw in the previous slide, the proportion of psychiatric ED boring in body EDVGs actually increased over time. And in terms of severity of psychiatric condition, both severe, non-severe psychiatric ED boring has similar increasing trend. Now, I will talk about findings from our statistical analysis of determinants of psychiatric ED boring in Oregon using our data. The first, there were several personal level factors that were significantly affected on increase in the chance of psychiatric ED boring.
Mr. Yoon, just a quick question.
Sure.
In terms of, so you see like an overall decrease in, you know, the ED visits, and then you see, you know, the percentage of psychiatric visits increasing. Is that relationship because we're getting the same amount of people, but it's...
No, that's not what this slide shows. This slide shows the percent that are being boarded.
Okay.
It's not the percent of total visits.
Okay, so and that was my question, was just making sure that that isn't a percentage of total visits, so that the number actually of being boarded is increasing.
So total number of boarded visits decrease over time. However, the proportion of a psychiatric ED boarding in the total ED visits increase over time. So there was, while the non-psychiatric ED boarding actually decrease over time.
Okay, so let me just clarify just to make sure. So looking on this slide right here, the going from the 9.2 to 12.2, does that represent a growth in the actual people that are boarded or a growth in the percentage of
growth in the percentage
people?
Ratio.
Okay.
Right. Exactly.
That's exactly what I was going to ask then.
Yes.
Because if I may, Mr.
Please,
Chair.
Please.
So that, I mean, I haven't previewed the slide, so I don't know if you're going to get there, but the real question is, what's the overall trend? You know, if the real question is not what the percent of total boarding is, but what percentage of psychiatric patients are boarded.
Well, yeah,
you know, and whether that's going down, not the percent of the total who are boarded. That tells us something, but the real question is, are we doing a better job overall getting them out?
So answering to your question is the data actually presented in our report, full report, the overall number decreased over time, slightly.
Right.
Okay. So it's just we're just not making as much progress in the psychiatric side as we are in the non-psychiatric side.
Right.
So okay, it's relative. So.
Well, relatively speaking, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So I'll proceed with the findings from statistics analysis. And we identify several personal level factors that explains greater chance of psychiatric ED boarding, including the severity of psychiatric condition, substance abuse, rural residence, and male gender. Enrollment in Medicaid was negatively associated with psychiatric ED boarding. I'll give you some example. Severe psychiatric PEDs were significantly more likely than non-severe psychiatric PEDs to be boarded by 16 percentage point. This is a huge increase given that 14.6% of all psychiatric PEDs were boarded. In addition, the boarding time was 10 hours longer for severe psychiatric PEDs than non-severe psychiatric PEDs. Medicaid enrollment significantly reduced the boarding time by average 2.7 hours.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
I think this is a really important point, and I want to make sure that we have a conversation about this, because this is yet another example about how overall we do a better job providing mental health services to our Medicaid patients. We have more resources available in the outpatient world than for people on commercial insurance. And I hear this all the time. It's particularly true in our rural areas, but it's true in our urban areas as well. The reasons for that need to be unpacked further, but certainly reimbursement rates, because we don't have true mental health parity in commercial insurance, and mental health providers are not reimbursed at the level they should be. But it is much easier to get mental health care in the state if you're on Medicaid than if you're on commercial insurance, and these data just reinforce that.
And Dr. Yoon, in terms of the Medicaid enrollment reducing the boarding time, or just having a correlation between that, there could be a bunch of reasons why that is. Does the data show any link between anything about why that may be occurring?
Our data doesn't really, contain information for us to explore why question.
Yeah.
But we can, speculate based on the literature, so providing better access to kind of preventive services.
Okay.
Mental health services. Yes.
Just if I may, I believe that some of the findings from the stakeholder interviews may help to answer the question you just raised. So,
okay.
But let me please. If it does or doesn't, let me know and we can try and come back to that. It would be helpful.
Thank you.
So I'll proceed. So further, we examined influence of system-level determinants with focus on the county-level availability of mental health resources. So our statistical model tested the extent to which the mental health resources affected the chance of psychiatric individuals and thereby psychiatric ED boarding. The ratio of patients served by assertive community treatment teams to persons with severe mental illness was used as a proxy for intensive county-level community mental health resources. Similarly, the ratio of psychiatric inpatient in public and private settings to persons with severe mental illness was used as a proxy for county-level inpatient mental health system resources. We found a greater availability of mental health resources was significantly associated with the reduction in psychiatric individuals. For example, 1% increase in intensive 1% increase in intensive community mental health resources led to 12% decrease in psychiatric individuals. Similarly, 1% increase in psychiatric inpatient capacity led to 9% decrease in psychiatric individuals. This results is after, you know, holding everything as constant in our statistical model. So compare to non-psychiatric visits, a psychiatric visit was related to a twofold increase in ED boarding and 5-hour increase in boarding time. So taken together, these findings confirm the greater availability of mental health resources led to a reduction in psychiatric ED boarding in Oregon. Now, Professor Locke will talk about interview results.
I might be able to figure it out.
So good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. Thank you for supporting this research and for inviting us to testify about it this morning. So in parallel with the quantitative analyses that Dr. Yoon just described, we interviewed stakeholders who were knowledgeable about emergency department boarding of psychiatric patients. Overall, during January and February of 2016, we interviewed 31 stakeholders from all regions of the state. They represented a variety of organizations. The largest number were from hospitals and emergency departments, both administrators and clinicians, and from county mental health departments. We also interviewed the representatives from community mental health programs, advocacy organizations, CCOs, and OHA staff. And I'd like to acknowledge that our colleague, Dr. Megan Kahn, conducted most of these interviews in collaboration with me and Dr. Yoon. So the interviews also addressed both the causes and the impacts of psychiatric boarding and potential solutions. And we found that the causes of psychiatric boarding, next slide please, fell into two main themes. First of all, that there are a significant number of emergency department visits that could be prevented in the first place. And second, that there are challenges in moving psychiatric patients promptly to the most clinically appropriate destination after they've been discharged from the emergency department. So I'll talk about each of those two main themes in one slide each. So the first main cause of preventable psychiatric emergency department visits is limitations in outpatient treatment capacity. In much of the state, there are long wait times to see a behavioral health provider. That can sometimes stretch to weeks or months, and a psychiatric emergency may occur before the patient can be seen. For people who have severe mental illness, in many counties, there's not sufficient capacity in community-based programs like ACT or intensive case management, because those programs require skilled staff, funding, and active local support. And there's often also limited availability of stable housing for persons with mental illness, and that's the foundation on which other treatments rest. When a person does develop a psychiatric emergency, there are alternatives to the emergency departments, but in some cases they're not as available as they could be or not as utilized as widely as they could be. The ideal response in many cases is a crisis response center or a mobile crisis team, but again, these are also challenging to staff and fund fully. There are a limited number of psychiatric emergency centers, which are centers that provide psychiatric emergency care but are in a much more effective way than just a standard emergency room. The Unity Center recently opened in Portland, we'll know more about that in the coming months as data are available. And then even when these alternatives are available, oftentimes providers or law enforcement are not familiar with them or not adequately trained to understand how to steer patients to these alternatives. So I guess one thing I should just say, it's not exactly on the slide. Most of the analyses that Dr. Yoon talked about are within the ED. Most of the things I'm talking about with the stakeholders are things that either happen before the emergency department or after. So after the emergency department, the next slide, our stakeholders estimated that approximately 3 out of 4 patients with a psychiatric emergency in the emergency department can go back to their home or to their family. But for the patients who do need more intensive treatment, it's often a challenge to find a setting that can accept them. Community residential treatment is often ideal, but slots are often not available, especially on the weekends, or for persons who have substance abuse or potentially violent behavior, other things in addition to mental illness diagnosis. Emergency department staff also often lack either training or the time to identify an appropriate community destination and go through the paperwork of setting up an admission. Now, for the patients who need the most intensive treatment settings, there are some shortages in capacity. I'm sure that you all have heard in detail about the .370 population and the backlog that creates at the Oregon State Hospital. Another alternative that was suggested by several stakeholders are subacute facilities, which are non-hospital settings but provide 24-hour mental health treatment. Those are ideal for many patients, but they're have limited capacity and are not reimbursed by all payers. And for persons,
Dr. Look, can you give us an example of what that kind of a facility is? I'm having a hard time visual. I mean, I'm just not sure I understand what that is.
So they're. I couldn't quote you the names, but they're not locked facilities. So they're psychiatric treatment facilities designed for people who need intensive mental health treatment, but not full-on inpatient mental health care. So, you know, not for people who are really dangerous to self or others, but they have treatment available. You know, they have a schedule.
Are they generally residential, or are
Yes.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, there are actually a couple of different types of the subacute or crisis programs that are residential. One is unlocked, as was referenced, and there are some programs out there that provide that. It's a shorter length of stay. You're talking about anywhere from, you know, 7 to 10 days of being able to just, you know, have a some respite and get some things in order. There are some block facilities that provide a little bit more intensive treatment services, sometimes referred to as subacute. There's one in Multnomah County, and then it's Crisis Assessment and Treatment Center, affectionately known as CATC. And then in Grant County, there's Juniper Ridge that also provides that level of service as examples.
And they're not reimbursed by payers because
they are Medicaid does cover them. So
and commercial does not because does anybody know what the rationale is?
No.
Thank you. I appreciate a one-word answer. Thank you, Mr. Morris. Okay, that's on our list of things to sort out.
Okay. And so there the people with psychiatric emergencies also require detoxification, and so for the capacity in those centers is also often difficult to find on a immediate basis, especially in rural areas.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Just a quick question. It sounds like there aren't a lot of facilities available in all parts of the state. Is there an example or examples? And you mentioned a couple of them, but are there examples of facilities that meet the different levels of needs for folks? And if there is, where is it? Or where are they? And it sounds like there's a capacity issue also. So it sounds like there's a need, but can you give me an example of a facility that meets the needs of most of these challenges that people are facing?
So, co-chairs and Representative Alonso Leon, there is an example down in Josephine County, Grants Pass. It's called the Crisis Triage CTC. I forget the T, but CRC, Crisis Resolution Center in Grants Pass, and that has different pods, and so it's a 16-bed facility, but they have one of the 5 beds that are reserved for a crisis respite and for that intensity and services. So there are models out there. There's one in Klamath County that has a similar kind of setup for that. So, and it is difficult in a smaller community to, it's hard to have a crisis facility unless you have other services there also that kind of build the infrastructure.
And, oh, Representative, may I just add to that one, the one thing that was mentioned in our interviews is that the location of the facility may not be close to where the person is. Like, for example, some of the subacute facilities that Mr. Morris described as being well-respected in the state are, you know, east of the Cascades, but if a person's having a, you know, psychiatric emergency in the Willamette Valley, that it may not be easy to set up, you know, the ability for that person to go to that place.
And we have 2 reports to get to, and we have another slide presentation on this report and then another slide presentation on the other report. So and we're going to be having 2 days on mental behavioral health, so if there are think about if those questions would be better on those days. But I've got Senator Winters and then Representative Malmstrom.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up on Representative Dion, and that's on the issue of availability. In your, is somewhere in your study, do you have a mapping that could tell us the location of what is? You know, these are generic kinds of comments, and it would be nice if we knew the availability in those that are available, that which is not, so somewhere we can look in the future where we needed to actually identify where resources should be targeted.
Co-chairs and Senator Winters, we can provide that. We have a mapping tool that can identify the locations. In fact, we can drill down a little bit more as far as what kind of services are provided in those types of facilities. We can categorize those for you.
That would be very helpful. Thank you.
Representative Malmstrom.
That question pretty much covers mine, but one other thing. Is Albertina Kerr still, they had a subacute and lockdown and open, and I realize it's only for, you know, younger people. Is that an example that would be, you know, more, you know, generic for a bigger block of people potentially?
Representative Malmstrom, yeah, that is an example of a crisis respite or subacute type of setting.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Please continue.
Okay. Thank you. So the next slide are with regard. Oh, I'm sorry. The impacts of psychiatric boarding. It was. All of our stakeholders described the impacts of psychiatric boarding as being negative for patients, their caregivers, for emergency department staff, and ED operations. One of the things that came through very clearly was that emergency department is not a clinically appropriate setting to treat a person with mental illness. And in fact, being in an emergency department for a significant period of time can actually exacerbate a psychiatric emergency. So. We also then were able to talk about potential solutions to psychiatric boarding. These also follow along between the themes of either preventing emergency department visits in the first place or expanding access to the most appropriate destinations after emergency department care. So there are several specific services that were suggested as potentially helping to alleviate psychiatric boarding rates. As I mentioned, community treatment programs, especially for people with severe mental illness, subsequent subacute facilities. Also, it was mentioned to have programs to assist persons discharged from inpatient care or the state hospital to transition back into the community and not fall back into crisis that takes them to the emergency department. And then supportive services like housing or substance abuse treatment can also help prevent psychiatric emergencies. For the .370 population, there's an ongoing discussion about the opportunity to treat more of the nonviolent groups among that population in community settings, and rather than just at the state hospital. The psychiatric emergency centers, as they open, especially Unity, we believe it'll be important to monitor the effectiveness of those. You know, we want to make sure that those centers don't get overwhelmed and backlogged just the same as emergency departments do. So we're very hopeful about that, but it deserves evaluation over time. There are some specific steps to be able to make the ED more supportive for psychiatric patients, things like peer support or some dedicated space for psychiatric patients. And as we just discussed, it would be productive to explore opportunities to improve reimbursement for non-hospital services, especially for Medicare or commercial, by Medicare or commercial payers. So just in conclusion, we can draw a few broad conclusions from our analyses. I would like to say that the perspectives of the stakeholder interviews were consistent with the statistical analyses Dr. Yoon presented and also with the published research literature about psychiatric boarding. It was very clear to us that the causes of psychiatric boarding are multifaceted. There's not a single or simple cause of this problem. And that solutions to it should really focus, as I mentioned, on keeping people out of the emergency department or moving them into the appropriate destinations. There was a broad consensus that simply adding more inpatient psychiatric beds by itself is not the solution to the boarding problem. And then, as I think as Senator Steiner Hayward mentioned, I just felt it was important to add that since the expansion of the Oregon Health Plan in 2014, insurance coverage for persons with mental illness has expanded significantly. Stakeholders repeatedly mentioned this. And if actions were taken in Washington that reduced enrollment in the Oregon Health Plan, this would likely exacerbate the psychiatric boarding problem.
Thank you.
One question. When you guys were looking at the range of treatment options or that were available, did you look at locations like, I think it's currently called Centerstone, and it's switching to Riverstone or whatever in Clackamas County? There's an analogous facility opening up in Washington County that both offers ongoing outpatient services and drop-off for police. Analogous in some ways to Unity, although a much smaller scale and without any inpatient capacity. Did you specifically look at the effectiveness of those kinds of services in diverting people from emergency departments?
That wasn't within the scope of our study, but Mike, are you able to comment on that?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, we haven't looked at as far as the effectiveness of it, but it is really anecdotally from the experience here in Marion County, as well as those other programs and expansion in Washington County, that the new Hawthorne Center are good examples of those.
Yeah, and do we think that they are? I mean, I can think of I've been on ride-alongs with various kinds of public safety officers, and almost every single time we end up with a person who really needs behavioral health care, but not a hospital emergency department. And thinking about those kinds of facilities strikes me as the kind of situation where it would be much better. I mean, they're not open 24 hours a day the way Unity is, but I think we need to be thinking more about those kinds of soft drop-off spots as options to decrease this. Because, you know, Representative Malmstrom, you brought this issue about is somebody known or not known. The reality is that with ED, the chances are pretty good that, and with the way our public safety officers are looking now, pretty much all the people with chronic significant mental illness are well known to the people who tend to care for them. It's hard to get somebody in de novo into the system at this point. So
Most of them are pretty well known.
All right, with that said, we need to move on to Mr. Morris, and you've got four slides and 5 minutes to get through them, so we can make sure that we respect DHS so that they have enough time to get through
Absolutely.
Their slides.
So I'll quickly give it a highlight, but I will be part of the panel presenting tomorrow, so if there's questions,
excellent.
I can respond to those questions. The first thing is really, although some of this data that they presented demonstrates that Oregon is comparable to other states in the country, we still see it as a significant issue. It looks like a small percentage, but those are very impactful situations for individuals and also for emergency departments. So we do see the need for action. And in particular, the data clearly show that those with severe psychiatric disorders are more at risk of extended stays in the emergency department. So some of the actions we're looking to as we move forward is to monitor emergency boarding. This is an issue that relies on us having more ready access to data, and so we're looking at strategies to have better reporting so that we can report on ED boarding. The other thing is to look at the expansion of our community services, which includes ACT program to serve community treatment. Currently, we have 23 teams in 21 counties. This is a growth of, we went from about 4 years ago, we now have 23. These are still, I would say, in their infancy, and we're doing a lot of support in the building those teams to be more responsive, and that's key to this particular issue. Part of our Oregon Performance Plan with the U.S. Department of Justice is to look at individuals with severe psychiatric disorders to come up if an individual has more than 2 readmissions in 6 months is to reach out and make sure we have a plan in place for those particular individuals and targeting those. About a year now, we hired an acute care coordinator to work on complex cases that end up in the inpatient units that need assistance to navigate and negotiate a return to the community. We have, through the investments from the legislature over the last 2 biennium, we have expanded mobile crisis services. It is in nearly all counties, not all counties, but I think all except for Curry County. But it is not necessarily available to everybody in the community. So you may have part of the county because of geography that has access to mobile crisis, but we need to expand it so everybody in those counties have access to mobile crisis. We're working on the 370 issue to expand community restoration to avoid people ending up at the state hospital for their restoration for that. We have, again, through investments from the legislature, we are working on the expansion or funding of development of community crisis services, these crisis respite type of programs, and the development funds that we receive for housing, part of that is available for these kind of services. We have been working to develop the psychiatric emergency services code to support the funding of psychiatric emergency services in hospitals, similar to the Unity program. We have, and we're using block grant funds, is we have had a 4 site pilot project for ED diversions for children and youth, using a lot of family peer supports, and we're looking to expand those pilots to 4 more sites, to a total of 8 sites. Some of the findings that we've had from that are promising. And then the last thing that is a work yet to be done, and it is a challenge, is that is to develop some sort of bed registry. This will require us working and partnering with the hospital association to see about. So this, what the registry is about is right now someone is in an emergency department, needs an acute inpatient bed. You start going down the list of hospitals and calling and seeing which hospital has a bed. This would enable an individual, someone at the emergency department, to look at the registry and see where the beds available are, and it just streamlines that process. So there are some challenges with that, so it sounds easy, but it is a difficult thing to do. But that's what we're going to be talking with the hospital association about, but the possibilities are there.
So. All right, well, thank you very much. And we'll go ahead. Ms. Ames, is there a recommendation?
Mr. Chair, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends acknowledging receipt of the report on boarding psychiatric patients in emergency departments in Oregon.
All right. Do we have a motion?
Oh, sorry. Didn't realize I was supposed to do that. Mr. Chair, move we acknowledge receipt of the report on the emergency department boarding of psychiatric patients.
All right. Chair Steiner-Hayward moves the LFO recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Motion carries. With that, I'll go ahead and carry it to the full. We'll close the work session on the Oregon Health Authority report and open a work session on the Department of Human Services report. I'll call up Director Tennedy. Thank you very much, and I apologize for trying to scoot through everything this morning.
Thank you.
Tried to get you at least 20 minutes. I apologize.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Lilia Tennity. I'm the director for the Office of Developmental Disability Services for the Department of Human Services. Today, I'm here to talk about the results of information we gathered in response to a budget note that went with a provider rate increase that went into effect January 1st of 2016. This is part of the budget note. Basically, it clearly states that the intent of the legislature is that money that went toward this rate increase be passed on in either compensation or wages and or benefits for direct care staff serving people with intellectual and developmental disabilities sometime during the 2015 to 2017 biennium. So the results, this budget note, and then we implemented the rate increase on January 1st, 2016, and then this report summarizes everything we did to collect information and the results of that for you. Our implementation strategy really focused on the services, of course, that the rate increase was intended to support. This is 24-hour group home settings for children and adults, supported living settings, and then employment and community inclusion services, which we also now call day services. We sent out public notice informing stakeholders and everyone that the rate increase would go into effect on November 30th, 2015. We, as part of doing this report and gathering the information required by the budget note, we required each provider that had a service that fell under the category of the 4% increase to submit a plan to us for how they were going to implement this, specifically how they were going to pass on either a wage increase or a benefit increase or some combination thereof to their direct support workforce. We also provided a letter for providers to pass on to their direct support workers that included an email address. If the direct DSPs wanted to complain, comment, tell us they didn't think they were getting what they needed, we gave them the opportunity to do that through this email address. And I also then communicated about everything going on with this report through several directors' messages that the most thorough of which we attached to the report that we submitted in detail to LFO. The results are that all provider agencies that were received a rate increase as a result of this did submit back to us their implementation plans. All providers indicated that they increased either wages, benefits, or both. About half, almost all, it says here, increased wages, and about half, that's what I was looking for, increased benefits. Other improvements included that we noted voluntary retirement plans, and then we did have some providers talk about how their health care costs were increasing, and so they used the 4% to, they absorbed the 4% in helping to pay for their increased health care costs. What I've got now in the presentation is a summary of what you'll find in the report itself in more detail. We had 86 group home providers, 82 increased wages, 47 increased benefits. I'm going to skip to the important points of this and not read everything on the slide. We did ask, as we were gathering this information, how many DSPs that the total provider agencies had. In the case of group homes, about 6,300. They reported that their average DSP wage was about $11.85. And then what we note at the bottom is our rate models. We have rate models for all of these different services. Rate models are based on assumptions, and then they come up with a total rate, and we pay the provider, and they take the rate and implement the services. Our rate assumptions for group home rates went to about $13.45 for direct support workers in the model as of after the January 1st increase. And for our Tier 7 category, that's individuals with significant needs above what our rate model generally covers, that went up to $11.23 an hour. The next results are supported living. Supported living is a smaller program, serves about 700 people. We have about 51 supported living agencies. You can see here that 50 indicated the increased wages and 29 increased benefits and 28 increased both. Only about 1,000 direct support professionals in this service area. The average wage for this particular service was reported as $12.20, and our rate model, our rate tool for this service, it went up to $11.23 for our DSP wage after the January 1st rate increase. Next one, similar summary, about 104 employment and community inclusion providers, 102 increased wages, 47 increased benefits, and about 45 indicated they increased both. 1,850 direct support professionals. This would be in services like employment path, what we call employment path community. We do have in this category workers like job coaches that actually we fund at a higher level than DSP because we have a higher training expectation behind them. So this one was a little bit convoluted because we may have gotten some reports of job coaches as opposed to the direct care staff doing DSA or employment path community. Our average DSP wage was reported as $13.46, and our rate model for the services in this category that include direct support professionals went to $11.23 after the 4% increase. I will say that the detailed report we provided to LFO, if you look to the back of it, not only do we include the director's message that I sent out explaining in great detail everything that was going to occur and what we were going to expect from providers, we also included the letter that we gave to providers about what was going to be happening and the letter we gave them and asked them to pass on to their direct support professionals explaining that they should expect to hear something from their provider agency about the increase either coming in wages and or benefits. More importantly, I think, and just demonstrating the level of detail that our providers gave us and also that the staff at ODDS went into to compile this report is by service area a list of every single agency and what they reported to us in the context of the 4%. So if you have agencies in your district that you're interested in what they did specifically around this, they're listed and included, and you can see what they reported to us. That kind of summarizes the report and the reporting effort that we did. We are clearly, as a system, the 4% increase helped with our direct support professional issues. As you know, you've heard not only from me and Joint Ways and Means, but I'm sure from all of our providers and advocacy, our direct care workforce, our direct support workforce continues to be an area of concern for all of us, given high turnover rates and other types of issues that they face.
I just had a couple of questions really quickly. So the email address that you guys had, how many emails did you get?
Co-Chair Rayfield, we have not did not receive any emails to it.
Oh, really?
And we checked. It's working.
Okay. and how did the email address, was that distributed in the letter to all the DSPs?
It was distributed in the letter. You'll see it in the letter that we asked providers to distribute to all DSPs. It was also in every piece of information that we sent out generally, publicly, about the increase.
And then from obviously the intent was that all the 4% would be passed on to the workers, and so we ask for their responses to kind of how was it passed forward. How do we verify that, you know, the full 4% or all of it got passed on to the workers?
Co-Chair Rayfield, this is one of the areas that's if we have to keep in mind the type of rate setting structure we have for these services. We do, as I mentioned, it's a prospective rate setting process. So we build a rate. This particular rate, most of the rates for these services, with a couple of exceptions, were built over a five-year period for group home. It ended in about 2008 when we started implementing. There are assumptions built into a rate model around what your administrative costs are going to be, how much you're going to pay in wages and benefits, how many staff you're going to have in each home, how long they're going to work, how many hours they're going to support a person in the home. There are assumptions about cars, vehicles. If you're an agency, we want to capitalize. We want to include some funding for you to purchase a vehicle to support people. Then all of that information is put into a rate. And in the context of group homes, we pay it on a monthly basis. Because it's a prospective fee-for-service rate model, we don't then go back to the provider agency and say, show us how you used what we assumed for administration fee as administration fee. Show us how what we paid you is going to, you know, the van that you bought. We do require them to submit for providers of $1 million or more, we expect them to submit audited financial statements, and for those who bring in less per year, just regular financial statements to us. We do some level of review. I would not say it's deep and thorough, because that would be a resource issue, and that's not the kind of staff we have that can go into and can do fiscal audit analysis. Beyond that, ultimately, we hold the providers to standards in our OARs, in our Oregon Administrative Rules, in our Medicaid program, and our approved waiver and K-plan. Ultimately, from my perspective in looking at the rates and just the situation, most of our agencies are nonprofit organizations managed by a board. Many of those boards include individuals and family members. Really, at the end of the day, what they do with their funding is demonstrated in the quality of care they provide to the people we're supporting. And if any agency hadn't passed this on or didn't pass this on, that's where we would see it. And I would also say that in the context of this process, I had several agencies report to us. We didn't include it in the report, but we do have several agencies who pointed out that even after they got a rate cut in the mid-2000s, if I recall exactly when it happened, they still provided wage increases and benefit increases to their workers because they needed to keep them and they valued the work that they did.
Yeah. And then just one last question, and thank you. The other thing that I noticed that was absorbed health insurance increases and other improvements. And so in the initial budget note, I mean, so in our business, we just always assume there's going to be increases in health insurance costs, right? And so it appears that some of the 4% was used to absorb some of those natural increases that just happen every year as a part of operating a business. And I wasn't around when the budget note was actually created, and you may or may not know the answer, and that's okay. Was that consistent with the budget note, that action? The intent, and I don't know if you know or if that's
answer.
Please.
I believe the language in the budget note was designed to provide for that kind of flexibility.
Okay.
Again, because
that's
providers are individual providers had individual plans and benefit packages in place. It was to allow them the ability to look at wages and or benefits to be able to provide the best thing they could for their employees with the rate increase.
Okay, and the reason I mention that is because when I think of it, because I was looking at the definition, it seemed a bit ambiguous, where it's like, to me, an increase in benefits means not maintaining status quo for natural planned increases in premiums. So that was where I got a little confused. So, okay, thank you. I appreciate it. The clarity.
Good.
Any questions? Am I the only one? We're just asking questions here. Representative Hayden, you look like you want to dig in. No?
I'm going to give you a pass today.
Okay, I appreciate that. All right. So with that, I guess we don't have any questions.
Thank you.
Outside of what I just did. Ms. Byerly.
Oh, Mr. Co-Chair, member of the subcommittee, there's an LFO recommendation for you and Ellis and a brief summary of the report. I would just like to note that, at least from my perspective, as far as what the agency did to compile information was, I think, probably more than we anticipated when the budget note was developed. So I think they did try to do a good job of wrapping things up. The providers came in during the short session last year and provided an update on their actions, but that was really right after the rate increase took place. So the agency did a good job of trying to summarize what happened. The issue is not gone away, so it's one that we'll continue to struggle with as far as trying to find resources for providers and to have a good understanding of how rate increases are passed along to those direct support professionals. So the LFO recommendation is to acknowledge receipt of the report.
Mr. Chair. You go so fast, Ms. Barley, I don't keep up. Mr. Chair, I move we acknowledge receipt of the report.
Co-Chair Stanley Hayward has moved the LFO recommendation to acknowledge the receipt of the report. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries. Madam Co-Chair, would you enjoy carrying this to
I'd
the full?
I'd be thrilled, although I do think we should assign it to Senator Winters, and she ducked out on us. But that's fine, I'll take it.
Do we know what?
We have the problem on this committee that there are exactly three of us on full, so we get to carry a lot of stuff.
With that, I share the sentiment, but we'll still have you carry
fine.
It to full.
That's fine.
And then we'll go ahead and close the work session. Ms. Byerly, is there anything before we adjourn today?
Nope. Back tomorrow for behavioral health.
All right. Now we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting for today. Look at this.